Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and herein we will continue our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. I'm very pleased about our guest today. Played a not insignificant role in my early writing life, Mark Derry, author of the new book, I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts. And back in the early 90s, we were fellow traveling scribblers, fascinated by the technology weirdness and pop cultural bizarreness of the era. And Mark invited me to contribute to his first book, a volume or originally a journal, called Flame Wars, which dealt with the kind of weirder fringes of the emerging techno culture at the time. And that piece became the sort of seed crystal of my book, Technosis. So I'm always been very happy to have Mark around, and not so much for the personal reasons as for his magnificence of a writer. For me, he's one of the most, if not the most, interesting cultural critic working right now, partly because his prose is phenomenal, and but in a great deal because the things that he looks at are the sorts of fascinating, macabre, abject, and disturbing things that in my own sort of more boring mind frame I don't tend to look at necessarily too closely myself, with some exceptions. And through Mark's eyes, I've been able to learn a great deal and look at a lot of those sort of dark corners of the cultural psyche, and to some extent the personal psyche. And in that way, I think he serves a really remarkable function. But he's also incredibly fun to read, even if the journey is a sometimes dark one. In addition to his new book, I just want to mention, so we don't forget it later, that he just posted a remarkable essay on Boing Boing called A Season in Hell, in which he describes his own long-term grueling, horrifying experience of going through cancer and then a series of other nasty operations on his guts. And it's a brilliant, beautiful, and deeply disturbing reminder of what the human body can deliver you. And just to give you a taste of his prose style, I picked out a paragraph towards the end of this piece where you get not only the playfulness of the language, but also the kind of ethical spirit, I would call it, that Mark brings to his work. As a career patient, I've learned one thing at least: the importance of clinging to the rag end of your sense of self, however you define it. Intellect, sense of humor, generosity of spirit, a stoicism worthy of Seneca or Mr. Spock, or in a writer's case, the mind that makes sense of itself as a reflection in the mirror of language. In the mass unit chaos of the ER, in the nowhere, no time of the hospital room, in the OR where the euphoria of oncoming anesthesia and the doting attention of apparitions in scrubs make you understand in an instant the perverse seductions of Munchausen syndrome as you ride into the stage light, radiance on your gurney like the son of heaven in his sedan chair, feeling for all the world like a pathological celebrity. In these moments of inescapable embodiment, I've learned to float free in my head, a thought balloon untethered from the body on the sick bed or the operating table. So I'm very happy to have Mark on. Before we bring him onto the show, we'll introduce, of course, our co-host, Maja Dau. Hi, Maja, how's it going?
It's going good. That was totally amazing.
Yeah. Now, have you ever had an operation like that? Have you ever been like in the deep nasties of the hospital world?
You know, for me, my deep nasties in the hospital were giving birth. So I have had terrifying experiences in there because my first birth went very badly, and all kinds of bad things happened, and the doctor messed up, and like not to get too gruesome, but I basically had a Franken vagina because he slipped with this thing and kind of sliced me, and then I had to get all these stitches. So that kind of floaty feeling, like you're completely removed under like someone else's control and all the lights, is a very good description of it.
Yeah, well, that sounds nightmarish indeed. It is funny how much we keep these things, sort of at bay. We go through them, and then when they're over, we put them aside. And that's true of so many cultural experiences, pathologies, etc. And so I'm very happy to bring Mark on to talk about this stuff. Mark, thanks for coming on Expanding Mind.
It's entirely my pleasure, Eric and Maja, and I'm delighted to be here. And I will say, as Christopher Hitchens did say when I once moderated a debate between him and the charlatan Rabbi Shmuley Botiak, thank you, Eric, for that suspiciously terse introduction. I think it's all going to be, I'm at pains, though, to inform your listeners that disappointingly it's all going to be downhill from the Franken vagina, a term I call dibs on for when you and I start the Norwegian death metal band we inevitably will, Eric.
Ooh, that'd be pretty good.
That sounds awesome. So Mark, in the new book, you cover so many marvelous, bizarre terrains, zombies, attacking animals, Capuchin monks, the Pope Mobile, on and on. It's just really remarkable. From whence cometh your obsession and fascination with the sort of hinterlands, hinterlands?
It's a marvelous question, and in some ways an unanswerable one, and I suppose this reveals that my deficit as a cultural critic, although I'm at pains to point out that it's the deficit of all cultural critics, which is that we are the last of the red-hot generalists in an age of nano-specialization. So like all cultural critics, my knowledge is a mile wide and a millimeter deep, which is a typically divagating way of saying that I'm not sure I've given that question enough thought, the question of why I'm drawn to the shadowy corners and the darker periphery, to the darkness on the edge of town, to the gathering shadows outside the secured perimeter of the status quo and mainstream consciousness. I'd like to answer the question by dodging your bullet. You said something very interesting in the introduction. You were talking about the sort of philosophical binary or antipodal relationship, polarized relationship, between my love of wordplay, my love of language, my obvious exaltation in style, and what you called my ethical consciousness, which I might call a kind of moral seriousness. And I would complexify that binary by turning it into a Triskelion, a tripart thing, a three-legged tripod, by adding, as kind of a subset of the notion of jeu de mots, of wordplay, the idea of what I call the politics of the polysyllabic, or the politics of the sesquipedalian. So I believe that there's kind of an ideology inherent in style. I believe that style is inseparable from content, and my style in many ways telegraphs my content or goes hand in glove with my content. It is a kind of a deeply principled ideological aesthetic rebellion, and some of the best rebellions, after all, are aesthetic rebellions. I'm thinking of surrealism. I'm thinking of situationism. It's kind of an aesthetic rebellion against the style that became dominant in the 20th century, which really grows out of Adolf Loos, the Viennese architect's famous essay, Ornament and Crime, in which he suggests that moral degeneration and the decay of civilization springs from the cloacal hothouse aesthetic of Art Nouveau, and he demonizes it in very gendered terms as this sump of feminine steaminess and moral depravity and Baroque ornamentation encrusting everything in its little shop of horrors, vegetal tendrils kind of writhing and wrapping themselves around everything. And he calls for a very brusque, masculinist, modernist, machine age aesthetic that will be all big shoulders and sharp angles, you know, and this is clearly premonitory of the Bauhaus and less is more. And then you get that same sensibility echoed in Strunk and White's famous Elements of Style, which I view as a deeply ideological book. And then Hemingway kind of carries that banner out into the popular arena. Well, I think there's a whole, I hesitate to use the sort of easy New Age binary of Dionysian versus Apollonian, but there's a whole subterranean dark river of aesthetics, most notably associated with Oscar Wilde and the Bloomsbury Dandies in graphic design and illustration, of course, Beardsley, but also notably Lautre et Malle and various other French decadents and symbolist poets and surrealist poets. And that is an aesthetic of the long Proustian paragraph, the long Jamesian paragraph, the sentence of infinitely complex syntax, dependent clause piled on dependent clause, this vast Baroque edifice. It is the equivalent in language of Gaudi's architecture. So I sort of champion that aesthetic, but at the same time, and this is the big but, and I hope you'll forgive my filibuster, I have to just get these things out.
No, I'm loving it.
It's just proving everything you're saying about your writing, that's
well,
all.
Exactly. And the danger, of course, is that if I stop for an instant, I will lose myself in the garden of forked paths, which parenthetically is why I do not smoke marijuana. I would find myself, in the middle, in some dead end in the middle of the conceptual labyrinth with no idea of how to get out. But all of that exists on the one side of my aesthetic and my, let's call it, writerly politic. And on the other side, there is a moral seriousness. Now, I can't find a better term, so I hope you'll forgive the term. But I should say that I shrink from it slightly, and I don't wear it completely comfortably. I've borrowed it from Sontag's Notes on Camp, where she says the two great sort of aesthetic political drivers of cultural discourse in the late 20th century are the queer and the Jew. The queer for his, she doesn't use that term, of course, but in so many words, she says gay culture for its irony, its arch sensibility, its love of kitsch and camp, and the way in which it constitutes a sort of a secret discourse, a kind of a semiological guerrilla warfare that counters the staid, excruciatingly earnest discourse of mainstream, which is to say straight culture, and then on the other hand, what she calls the moral seriousness of the Jew. Now, I find that problematic. I don't think Jewish culture has a copyright on moral seriousness, and I complexify this dynamic because I believe moral seriousness can be the dead hand of killing ponderous, self-important moral judgment, which I see as quintessentially American. I really do believe this is a country that stinks to heaven of God bothering, and that the Judeo-Christian tradition continues to pervade the cultural unconscious. So I embrace a more Ballardian or Barthesian sort of a morality, which is to say I'm very concerned with moral and ethical questions. I don't believe the religious right should have a lock on contending with moral questions or philosophical investigations of that sort. But like Barth, who famously said, I rejoice in ideas lightly held, ideas that can be discarded in an instant, I love that Gallic whimsy, that lightness, that lack of Teutonic ponderousness. And in the same way that Eric Satie said, what does classical music need? Less sauerkraut. In the same way about sort of leaden philosophical moralizing that wears the mantle of its virtue heavily. So I'm very interested in the etymological Latin roots of the word fascinating, which I find very instructive, and I was always quite taken as a kid with Mr. Spock on the old Star Trek's ultimate sort of applausive comment, which was fascinating. And like Ballard in Crash, I love the fact that no moral judgment is implied. It beckons us into a universe where things are simply fascinating or not.
Well, and fascinating is like phantasmagoria. It comes from phantom, which essentially is like a trick of the light or something flashy. Comes from phantom fascinate. It's the same origin, and it's all about a trick of a light that holds your gaze, like when you're hypnotizing someone and you're waving the clock in front of their eyes.
Well, that's absolutely fascinating. saying it, I hadn't known about the connection to phantom, but my understanding from the OED was that it was rooted in the Latin fascinans, which, as you rightly point out, has to do with bewitchment, mesmerization.
Ghost. Yeah.
And it is very much an appeal to the retinal cortex.
Exactly,
so
flashing
with,
light.
Yeah, the beheld world, material color, culture, the fascinations of the object as in itself. And so in the same way that, you know, the people poking the severed hand in Anshan and Delu, the little child fascinated by the roadkill, roiling with maggots, I think there are certain things that, while physically repugnant, are also simultaneously fascinating, also even if they are morally repugnant. And that's why I am drawn again and again to Hitler in this essay collection, and why I talk in it as well about Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr.'s notion of the pathological sublime.
Well, let me interrupt here and riff a little bit on this fascination thing.
Sure.
Because I find it fascinating. I mean, partly because it's something that I've been brought into my own life, in the sense that I find, you know, particularly it's a comment that I often make with my wife when we're out, you know, gallivanting about and going to weird cultural scenes and meeting odd characters or whatever, where I find myself that the most appropriate response is to actually just say, "Fascinating, Captain." And what it captures precisely is the blend of this, you know, visceral, you know, almost pre-conscious, dreamlike draw towards the object of excess, of oddness, of occult splendor, of baroque weirdness, of repulsive, you know, excess. And at the same time, it's a feeling and a stance that we associate very much with a kind of, I won't say scientific, but a certain kind of objective recognition that the world on some level is the way it is, and that there is a kind of freedom and certainly a kind of truth in that that's incredibly beautiful and rarely sought out. And the other way that I approach that, you know, particularly on a more personal level, although I think it's relevant, is this whole question of things that are repugnant and how you respond to them. And one of the ways that I've done that in my life is that, like, I'm fascinated by smells. I have a preternaturally good sense of smell, which is basically a curse. In the sense that the sort of tangy metallic sweat of teenagers is very evident. The slightest bit of rot or proximate garbage in a restaurant becomes picked up. So that I have a lot of opportunity to relate to the repulsive.
Yeah.
And I've developed this habit, this stance, this way of responding to it, where I look at it and I go, wow, like, let's articulate and analyze and recognize the particular characteristics of this repugnance, of my response, of the aesthetic qualities.
That's interesting, Eric, because then fascination becomes almost like an alchemical ordeal, because there's attraction and there's repulsion.
Mm-hmm.
You would think when something repulsive shows up, you would get away from it and go away. But what fascination does is attract you to the repulsive.
Yeah, and with Mark's work, what I really like is how you have a line in there somewhere about the talking about, like, the, approaching the internet with a drift net, you know, and you go in there and you find the most insane, just freaked out, yes, repulsive aspects of human desire and fascination and fetishism, you know, the decapitation fetish and all these bizarre, sexual obsessions. And what I really like about those is this image of you sort of like searching and finding and like sounding the depths, as it were, of this remarkable, bizarre, and you know, a very excessive medium. So I'd love to hear you reflect a little bit, since we first met over the hot coals of techno culture, just how your relationship and attitude towards the internet as a sort of source, as a reflection, as a repository, as an archive, has developed for you over the years?
Well, I'll absolutely be happy to respond to that, but let me quickly just snatch a few of the fireflies of the fascinating, to use the term of art and the word of the day, ideas that you and Maja just swatted around. One thing that I think is really important to italicize here, and I'm grateful to both of you for bringing it up, I think it's an absolutely compelling and endlessly intriguing idea, is this notion that sensations can be ideas. You know, there's something like an idiomatic expression or kind of a popular catchphrase in which people say, you know, it's either like, it's like Brussels sprouts. You either like them or you don't. Well, since my job description is professional overthinker, and I'm interested in overthinking, overtalking, and overwriting, obviously, it seems to me that saying I don't like Brussels sprouts is just the beginning of the philosophical investigation. I believe we should ask why of everything, even visceral sensations. And I don't know if either of you have read William Ian Miller's fascinating book, The Anatomy of Disgust, but it's a really intriguing philosophical investigation because he delves deep into the very philosophical essence, the dark beating heart of disgust, which most of us would tend to just dismiss out of hand as a visceral reaction, almost a kind of a physical sensation. And so how can we possibly parse it intellectually? Well, of course, everything is historically bounded. Everything is culturally situated. I know Eric believes this, and I gather from you, Maja, that I suspect you would accept that premise as well. And so everything is fraught with ideological meaning and hopelessly contaminated by cultural narratives. And so something like you said a moment ago, that we're fascination draws us to the disgusting, I'm not quite sure I completely agree with that, because we're also fascinated by things, I think, arguably, that aren't disgusting. Mm. But it's especially, I'll meet you halfway, it's at its most pungent and reverberant, and strikes the most interesting philosophical responsive chord in it when you combine a repulsion and attraction in the experience of fascination. Mm-hmm. And that's why I hold forth at such length in this book, in the essay Aphrodites of the Operating Theater, which was inspired by the so-called anatomical Venuses, the wax obstetric mannequins from the 18th century on display in La Specola, a scientific museum in Florence. And I bring to bear on these exquisite models, some of which border on the disgusting or the appalling or the horrifying. The obstetric model mannequins are fine. They were teaching aids for 18th and 19th century doctors, and they were cast from cadavers. Every eyebrow hair, every hair on the scalp, elaborate, fastidiously implanted with tweezers using horse hair or real human hair, bone or ivory teeth inserted. So they are absolutely hyper-real. And then you lift the cover off the belly to reveal twins in utero. You know, every glistening, gleaming aspect of the lymphatic system or the arterial system, you know, completely hyper-realistically rendered. But then there are wax models of epidermal pathologies, people with their faces eaten away by syphilitic lesions and, you know, pocked by enormous pustules, or grotesque hypertrophy of facial cancers and so forth. Now, the artistry is breathtakingly beautiful, scientifically endlessly fascinating, but the subject matter is unimprovably grotesque,
and yet it's our own physical form.
Yeah.
So the irony there is that people call it grotesque, and yet it's what we live in and breathe in every day. I mean, regardless
exactly.
of the disease disformity, the fact that that is grotesque is ridiculous, because
yeah.
it's what we are.
Yeah, and that's why I refract that experience through the useful prism of Oliver Wendell Holmes's Senior's essay called On the Pathological Sublime, where he, in the 19th century, tells his brother surgeons in Boston, writing in a Boston medical journal, hey, you guys have got to see this fantastic exhibition of paintings by a Chinese painter named Lam Qua of their before and after paintings, lovingly rendered in 19th century painterly technique, almost as sublime as landscape paintings, of people with enormous tumors before and after their removal by a missionary surgeon in China. And he says, I call the emotion we experience looking at these things the pathological sublime, because it's like the Burkean sublime, just like the wanderer among the in the fog in the Caspar David Friedrich painting. We see this breathtaking thing that is as emotionally overwhelming as an abyssal drop or a craggy mountain summit, and yet it's the pathological body. And so I find it a very useful concept. So all of that is just to say I'm very much intrigued by the points both of you make about how gut response can be a kind of intellectualization.
Yeah,
well, in fact,
it's
in
a
your
form
gut.
Of thinking. And it also reminds me, this maybe brings up another kind of moral dimension, is that, you know, part of the culture that all three of us, I know, you drew off of and was very important for us was the kind of sort of moment that it kind of arises in the 1980s with, you know, research magazine and Amok books and this kind of world that peels back the pathological. And yet you find, or at least I find, I think you would agree, you certainly do in your comments on Adam Parfrey, that there's a certain kind of, there's a tendency of within that culture to sort of revel in it. I mean, it's not quite the right word, but there's a sort of unthinking indulgence in the shock as shock.
Yeah.
As if the opening is made, but the thinking isn't done. And that extra turn towards whether you think of it as moral seriousness or you think of it as just better analysis, as a deeper understanding, is also partly what sets your work apart from so many people who are, you know, drawn to this kind of material. Where does that come from? What is that? What's at stake with that?
Oh,
kind
of... it comes from having been a born again Christian, Eric, as I think you know. And it comes from long hours and hard time in the unforgiving straight back pews of my Lutheran church as a child.
I just wanted to add.
A pall falls over the conversation.
No,
I wanted to add just really quickly your comment about the gut and intelligence, just because they did find that you have a second brain in your body. That there's a ganglion
mind.
Of nerves in your solar plexus that actually have as many neurotransmitters, sometimes more, as there are in your brain. That's why when you take antidepressants, it messes with your stomach.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you've read the Boing Boing essay that Eric referred to, A Season in Hell, about my cancer year, as Harvey Pekar would call it. But I, subsequent to my cancer surgery, which was abdominal, I had two intestinal blockages 2 years apart. And the surgery for them is typically a moment's work, although it was much more complicated in the second instance for me. But the run-up to it is positively gothic, and I'll spare your listeners the agonizing details from the front lines. But in that, I talk at some great length about what you just referred to, which is the enteric mind or the gut brain.
Yeah.
We should say that regardless of how many sort of neurons it has, it's not capable of reading the user's manual to a Mac Air or piloting an F-15. You know, we shouldn't imply a kind of an amusing equivalency between the gut brain and, you know, the homunculus up in the seat of reason moving the levers of power. But it is far brighter than we ever imagined. And disconcertingly, it's far more willful than we ever knew. And I quote this hilarious book that has a title that's straight out of the Firesign Theater. It's something like, Your Brain is Not the Boss.
Oh, that's good.
And I mean, that's actually not the title, but it's something like, would that it were.
Well, your gut brain is the impulse, right? It's fight, flight, do. It's the primal, the reptilian. Like, of course it can't figure stuff out. It only, its intelligence is only that pure guttural reaction.
No, that my understanding is that's your so-called reptilian hindbrain, which is the very beginning of, you know, the snail-like evolutionary spiral that finally coalesces into the full-blown human brain, full-blown cortex. But the gut brain, the enteric brain, which is all the neurons located in your digestive tract, has a lot of processing horsepower because it's come to find out it's got an extraordinarily complex job to do with the whole digestion excretion process. And given St. Paul's unhappy legacy in American culture, as you were pointing out, this overly fastidious, hysterical recoil from the world, the flesh, and the devil, and that includes excretion, it's a delicious irony that come to find out our bowel is far brighter and more rebellious than we ever knew. I mean, in Miltonian terms, it's, you know, the Satan coiled at the seat of all things.
Well, this is wonderful stuff, and I want to point people against you to Mark's essay, A Season of Hell, on Boing Boing. But we got to take a break right now.
Great.
You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking to Mark Derry, author of the new I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou, and we're here talking with Eric Davis and Mark Derry about anatomical goings-on. And I wanted to say something about something I like that you brought up in your book, which is the precursor to the bowel situation, which is the teeth, of course. The teeth process everything that then goes into the bowels and cause all the mayhem that happens. And I really liked your little chapter on talking about teeth and their symbolism and going to the dentist, because the teeth are pretty big metaphors to me for lots of things. They kind of represent your entire body system and a lot of different alternative medicine things. But I like, too, that you brought up the tooth vagina, of course. I know, being a Franken-vagina gal myself, but a lot of people don't know about that. And, in fact, when I was doing research on Medusa, I came across some of Freud's business on this tooth-vagina thing, and there is that horror movie about the tooth-vagina, which is pretty hilarious, but that it was so ironic just that Freud had this kind of thing with teeth, and then he, of course, gets cancer of the jaw, and how our and it reminded me of, I'm sure you know George Bataille, who got famous for the story of the eye, but he did a little essay on teeth and their symbolism, how we kind of show each other our teeth, and it's as a smile, but it's also kind of a threat, because that's what we use to eat things. And just, anyway, maybe you could talk a little bit about what you mentioned in your book, going through the surgery and how it kind of connected you to that.
Well, I'd be delighted to. Teeth are an evergreen subject for me, or in my case, ever yellow. I haven't undergone the obligatory tooth whitening that every American is contractually obligated to undergo here in the land of radiantly synthetic dentistry. But you're referring to the essay Open Wide, whose subtitle is Dental Horror, in my new essay collection, I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts. And a few things occur to me, and I do want to answer the question Eric asked a moment ago about the internet and net criticism. So I'll try to be as pithy as possible, which will probably strain me greatly. But my approach to cultural criticism is it's almost like prestidigitation or parlor magic or a kind of a parlor amusement for, you know, Mensons. I like to squeeze every droplet of polysemic meaning I can out of something. And so it's sort of a dance with the floating signifier. In most of these essays, I'm saying, you can read this cultural text this way. It might mean this, it could mean that, or rather, it does mean this, but it also means that. And so with teeth, I use personal experience, which is something I'm trying to do more and more in my approach to the essay, is to use the personal essay in more of a Montaigne sense as a philosophical investigation refracted through personal experience, with the emphasis on subjectivity and viscerality, the fact that I am the body in the crosshairs of the analysis, rather than the kind of sacrosanct sentimentality that seems to infect the American definition of the personal essay. You know, for most Americans, the personal essay is a mediocre middle-brow figures like Anna Quinlan, you know, pontificating on making her children's school lunches, or, you know, tub-thumping George Will essays at the back of Time magazine, inevitably titled My Turn. So the Montaigne philosophy, the more Gallic approach of being personal but not being confessional or mawkishly sentimental in the American way, is what really interests me. So in this essay, I try to do that. I try to write a personal essay that is nonetheless a philosophical investigation, that is nonetheless cultural criticism, bringing to bear the full armamentarium of techniques and methodologies from cultural studies, to look at the dentist as a gothic apparition in the popular imagination. And you mentioned teeth. And one of the Bataillean moments, invoking Georges Bataille in this essay, is the idea of teeth as sort of inherently uncanny, which is self-evidently preposterous. I mean, they're part of us, but they are also other in that sense that is always there, which is that we both have bodies and are bodies. We're both somewhat alienated from our bodies as clouds of thought, and yet we are hopelessly implicated in the flesh that we are part of and synonymous with. And so that you can read the teeth as a fun act of philosophical surrealism, as these eruptions of the other, as the skeleton struggling to fight its way out of the flesh and assert itself, and just the sheer perversity of that exegetic strategy, of that analytic act, really appeals to me. I mean, some of these analytical points are absolutely tongue-in-cheek. The question isn't, do you really believe this? It's, what if one were to actually believe this? And so I'm simply tendering it. I'm simply submitting it to my reading public for its delectation. I'm not saying this is the case, because to me that question of is this or is this not true, again, Barth is helpful. Barth says, you know, the question of is it fascinating is much more interesting than is it true.
I think that approach to what you might call overreading, I think, is really, really key. It's something I'm very inspired by, and I definitely did. I've done a lot in my writing. I think my Led Zeppelin book is probably the example of that, in the sense that, and it kind of freaks people out, because yeah. I would just be like, let's see how far we can read the fourth Led Zeppelin record as a sign of some occult conspiracy.
Yeah.
And it really puzzled people, because, you know, there's this sort of inherent kind of lowbrow, no, I don't know about it's lowbrow, but just a sort of programmed response that the position of a critic is going to be resolving a certain kind of truth and making a certain kind of declarative argument, when
yeah.
really it seems like what we want to be doing is encouraging everybody to read more, to let it resonate, to approach it from multiple angles, whatever it is, whatever thing catches your eye, whatever kind of fascination grabs it, and it's you know, it's a marvel that you're you know, able to continue to do this. But even though I did ask that question about
yeah.
the internet, I must say I'm more interested in getting a little bit here, since we were talking about personal experience.
Yeah.
In addition to the use you've made of your own body and your own experiences in some of these essays, and I strongly encourage you to continue down the Montaigne path. You've also, some of the most effective essays in the book are, for me, the most resonant, also have to do with your own upbringing, your own childhood, your own life as a child, the world you were in, which is a world very similar to my own, Southern California,
yeah.
In the sort of you know, drag end of the hippie era, which is the zone that you call Stoner Noir, and you have great essays in there. In you know, Facebook of the Dead is just absolutely fabulous.
So good.
The material on David Bowie—it's just great, great stuff.
Thank you.
So I wanted to ask you about that too, in the sense that you know, I think again, like the some cultural critics would feel that like there are certain zones where I can refer to my own experience or my own angle, but you know, only so far, really. And it seems like there's some you've discovered or you've been able to articulate and present to others the real. You know, the intense load that we carry from our childhood, both in terms of our internal peculiarities and in terms of the specific cultural world that we came up from. You're not saying, hey, I have an objective view, I can objectively account for this cultural phenomenon. You're like, hey, I grew up in a certain time and space, but that doesn't limit my ability to read deeply. In fact, in a lot of ways, it encouraged it.
Yeah.
So just because the phrase itself, Stoner Noir, is so great. I'd love to for you to riff a little bit on what growing up in that bizarre Southern California track home stoner zone did for you, and how it shaped the way that you approach things.
Well, I can certainly do that. Let me offer to the two of you and your listeners, in light of that question, the option of having me read a brief excerpt from the essay you mentioned, specifically the section on stoner noir. Is that the sort of thing your interviewees ever do? Would it be useful?
I would, in fact, I got to tell you, Mark, synchronicity speaks. I had already marked out a section, but I felt like I already read one. I didn't want to read another one, so I will be delighted to have you read it.
Well, Maja, should I?
I would like nothing better.
Okay. And Eric, my thought was that I would read just the section on stoner noir, but did you have a specific paragraph picked? Because it goes on a bit, and I wonder if we can zero in on a single paragraph or two.
Sure. Just I think the single paragraph that tops the page, 123.
Okay.
And the next one maybe.
Okay. Sounds good. So the essay in question is called Facebook of the Dead, and to make the pun swing, I have the word face in parentheses, so it will read both ways, because it is, in a larger sense, an essay about some of the social pathologies and the psychodynamical weirdnesses enabled by social media in the age of Facebook. And I, by and large, cordially loathe that too clever by half, at this point, very 80s academic move of putting parentheticals around something in the middle of a sentence, you know, researching Jane Austen's Frankenvagina or whatever. You know, I mean, there's a whole blood sport in mainstream newspapers in publishing the titles of MLA panels, and inevitably they have parentheses around one of the words. But in any event, I had to do it in this instance. So I hope those who read it will forgive me. But I talk about how on Facebook, the old Swinburne line that we can take comfort in the knowledge that no life lives forever, that dead men rise up never, is not true in the age of Facebook. And as I put it, more often than not, that knock on your inbox door is the risen dead from your high school yearbook. Classmates you thought you had safely buried in the boneyard of forgotten things with a gentle shovel tap on the face. And so then I talk about the fact that in my case, I grew up in Southern California, and while I've been delighted to re-meet some of the people from my high school, it's not a time and a place that is without gothic shadows for me. And so here's the paragraph Eric was referring to. The sludge-brained enemy of stoner noir is just what it looks like, the rudderless yawing of youth culture on the morning after the 60s. It's the numb realization that the tide that carried in the counterculture's utopian dreams and cries for social justice has ebbed away, leaving the windblown scum of Altamont and My Lai, the Manson murders, and the Zodiac killer. Stoner noir stares back at you with the awful emptiness of the black hole eyes and a smiley face. Have a nice decade. As late as the mid-70s, the iconography of rebellion, at least in the tract home badlands of Southern California, was a politically lobotomized version of hippie. The bootleg records, blacklight posters, underground comics, patchouli oil, and drug paraphernalia retailed at the local head shop. But stoner noir isn't just the burned-out roach of 60s youth culture. It's equally the toxic mental runoff of suburban sprawl. dirthead existentialism. It's the psychological miasma that hung like the sweetly rotten reek of Thai stick over adolescent psyches battered by divorce, lives dead-ended in high school, torpid afternoons bubbled away, and a journey to the bottom of the bong. Stoner noir is the default mindset of teenage wasteland, life seen through a glass pipe darkly.
Wow, I just love that. Probably just because it brings, you know, evokes so many memories for me. I think that I have the slight advantage over you in that though I came later into the game, and so there was a sort of Reaganite counter bash emerging already in my fellow high school students. I just lived in a more pleasant and beautiful place. it was just easy. I was on the coast, so we could go to the beach, and there were lots of canyons, and so it was. But in other ways, you did a remarkable job of capturing that place. But even more specifically, that time, a certain kind of residue of the counterculture, which you're both affected by, and then there's this evident, dark side right there in your face, or reflecting through the blacklight, painting or whatever. But how is that kind of, as you older New Yorker, working on this on contemporary materials, how does that legacy stay with you? What does it tell you about?
It's a great question, and I'm so glad you asked, because it really does. Your question strikes a real responsive chord in me. Let me first say that passage in that essay in general stirred up quite a bit of sediment on the web, but that passage resonated so powerfully, or touched off sympathetic vibrations in so many, interestingly I would say, men, a very few women, but gentlemen, shall we say, of a certain age, old enough to remember the early to mid 70s. You are some years my junior, I think. I'm 52. But in any event, that formulation, stoner noir, encapsulated for many people who read the essay something they'd never quite put their finger on. Sontag in Notes on Camp says there are many things that are not known and many things that are known but not named, and then she names one of those things as camp. Well, I think stoner noir was a very useful handle for people to pick up the penis-shaped beer bong of mid-70s ennui and teenage wasteland. So if one's role as a cultural critic is only to coin a phrase, a neologism, is to give something a name, both of you are students of magic and spirituality. I mean, the naming of things is a fantastically powerful act, and I would be happy to have the few useful tropes I've bequeathed to popular culture inscribed in my headstone. I don't think that's a small act.
It's the act of a magician.
Yeah, thank you. But so back to the question of how that time affects me now. Well, San Diego is breathtakingly beautiful. I was just back there, and I believe that the Torrey Pines cliffs and the La Jolla, the tide pools, are and also canyon country and the unique coastal ecology of all of Southern California, but specifically San Diego, is what's called coastal desert, a wonderful oxymoron, really emblematizes the ethos and consciousness of hybridity, ambiguity, ambivalence, intermingling that I embrace as a cultural critic, that confounds and does end runs around and pops wheelies around hierarchical dualisms and the philosophical binaries that, as Haraway teaches us, have structured Western epistemology at least since the Enlightenment. That doesn't mean I'm not prey to them. My own style of mind tends to be very binary. I'm always thinking in sort of Manichaean this versus that terms. But I think I've matured enough as a critic to complexify that and question that and ultimately train the crosshairs on all my own binarisms. And I attribute a lot of that to growing up in what I call the suburban badlands and borderlands of San Diego's South Bay, hard by the Tijuana-San Diego border. And I think Tijuana, unlike for you, Eric, for you, it's kind of canyon country and the coast and the sort of illimitable vastness of the Pacific that is some sort of Jungian signifier, I think, in your formative memories. For me, it's Tijuana, this Brechtian mahogany, this Joycean night town, this Barrosian zone that serves as this gravity well of attraction and emblematizes the polymorphously perverse, you know, the wonderfully seedy, the sort of cheap thrills and popular pleasures of seamy culture, and is sort of a Disneyland of depravity contra San Diego's, as Gore Vidal put it, Vatican for the John Birch Society. So that was very formative, and I think growing up near a border really induces, for those who are attentive, a sort of love of hybridity and polymorphously perverse and ambivalence and ambiguity, as I say, this sort of philosophical banner of the both and rather than the either or.
Well, I just want to let you know we only have a couple of minutes left here, so I didn't know if you wanted to point people to any events or online, you know, extravaganzas that you're pushing at the moment. So I just wanted to let you know that.
Oh, marvelous! Well, thank you. I'll just say that I do hope people will at least consider browsing the book on its Amazon page. And the book, once again, is I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts, and the subtitle is Drive-By Essays on American Dread, American Dreams. New York listeners may be interested in hearing me lecture and attending the book launch party. That is this Sunday, the 29th, at 6 p.m. sharp at the Cornelia Street Observatory. If you Google that phrase, you'll turn it up in an instant. And then next month, I believe, I'm going to be at Cabinet Magazine's headquarters in Brooklyn, hard by the pestilential Gowanus Canal, and all the better for that.
Marvelous. And then you're working on a biography of Edward Gorey.
I am, for Little Brown. And as I told an audience in San Diego where I was lecturing recently, I did two lectures there and then I appeared at the LA Festival of Books. I said, as the palely loitering goth in the endless summer of Southern California who collected newspaper clippings of surfers devoured by sharks, I was born to write this book.
No, I'm really, really happy, too, that you have a nice book-length project to sink your teeth in. I think you're a master of the short essay, but there's something about that particular form that I think will be a real a powerful challenge and a great launching pad for the continued evolution
of
your writing.
Well, thanks so much.
So, well, I think that about wraps it up. Mark, thanks so much for being on Expanding Minds.
That was fantastic.
It was my immeasurable pleasure. Thanks so much to both of you for your brilliant, penetrating questions.
Awesome. Well, from Maja and me to all you out there, keep your minds open.